Hello and welcome back to the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast for, well, it'll be for Monday, April 24 by the time I'm done editing this. I'm Dane Cash, and what you've just heard is the musical brilliance of my co-host joining me as ever this week, cycling analyst extraordinaire and apparently musician extraordinaire, Cosmo Catalano.
A minor music theory student. Yes, here I am. Hooray. I do like that song, Dane.
I was so glad to get to you. I mean, it's very catchy. It gets stuck in my head. And I was very glad that after all these years, I got to put it at the beginning of a podcast.
Yay.
So, yay. Also joining Cosmo and me this week, we've got Ruth Winder. Ruth Winder, who, let's see, Ruth, what have you done in your career this week? Ruth Winder, who won the Tour de Femmes in 2017. Yeah. Welcome to the show, Ruth Winder, former U.S. national champ. Great to have you back.
Thanks. Good to be back.
And Chief Tartan Correspondent, live from Edinburgh, Kit Nicholson. Welcome back to the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast.
Yeah, good to be here.
I don't know that we have any other Tartan correspondents, but I feel like you're the top of that hierarchy for sure.
Well, now that I've written an essay on Tartan on the website, I suppose that
Yeah. If you're listening to this podcast and you don't know what we're talking about, head on over to escapecollective.cc. And go read about it. Also subscribe, because we love when you do that. It makes us very happy. And we make better shows when we're happy. So we're here to talk about the Ardennes Classics, specifically Liège-Bastogne-Liège. That's the race that we all just watched. We watched the women's race like 12 hours ago, because for whatever reason they decided that one had to finish way before the men's race. And then the men's race we just saw. So let's start with the women's race, because it was underway first and finished first. Cosmo Catalano, what happened in the women's race?
There was a really strong break. Not sure when they went away, because they were there when we got on TV. Marlon Reusser rode away from the break when she went up Redoute. There was a relatively ineffective chase till Amanda Spratt was caught. Trek chased her pretty effectively. Elias de Longo Borghini and Vollering bridged across. They did bridge across. Actually, a group of six got together. Reusser got clear in a descent. Longo Borghini got up to her at the bottom of the descent. Estee Works was like, actually, this is not the combination we want. They magically switched Vollering and Reusser, and then they went in. Longo Borghini and Vollering went into the line together and had a pretty good two-up sprint that Vollering won pretty convincingly. So.
And in so doing, she won the Ardennes triple. She, of course, won Amstel. And then La Flèche Wallonne. And then, today she took her second straight Liège-Bastogne-Liège win. So Demi Vollering, I think, tip of the cap to her. She's had a pretty good season so far. I'm pulling up her results just to get a sense of how good of a season she's having so far. So in the last 7 one-day races that she has done, she has won 5 of them. She didn't win the Tour of Flanders, but her teammate did. So that was pretty good. The only one that she didn't win and that a teammate didn't win was Brabantse Pale. But even in those two races, she was second. So that is a run of dominance that I think, well, SD Works has to be pretty happy with it. And Demi Vollering, still only 26 years old, has really, I think last year everybody knew she was I guess probably not fair to say she's coming into her own now, because she was already pretty darn good last year, already won Liège last year. But this is a sort of dominance that we have not seen from her yet. And at this point, I feel like she's just at the top of the women's peloton right now. It's kind of hard, I think, to say otherwise. So another big win for SD Works, which just keeps winning bike races. Cosmo, you wrote here on our run sheet that Trek showed a lot of patience. And at least that means that another team tried to challenge SD Works and came pretty darn close with Longoboard gaining at the end.
Yeah, other teams have been trying. Trek, I think, was very... I think it's easy to get overactive, especially... Like, we kind of saw it in Amstel. There's just a lot of attacks, a lot of stuff happening, and SD Works not doing very much. And this was very much, you know, SD Works got in a pretty aggressive position. Trek was there. They had Sprout up the road, too. But after Royster got clear, they were very hands-off. They let Movistar throw this chase by attack that really wasn't working. And then really waited till they had Sprat there and went full on. And you could see that they split the field in that chase and, you know, basically got free separation. And it was really well-timed. And within, you know, the final 15K, they had a great selection for them with Longoborghini and Royster. And just SD Works had that over the Côte de Non Classé, the unclassified climb at the end of the race, were able to switch them around. And I think, you know, even if Gaia Realini had been a little bit, not that she did poorly by any means, but if she'd been a little bit more keyed in on holding Vollering's wheel, she could have gotten across and given them a lead out. I thought they rode really well and really strategically, really picked the moments where they wanted to race hard and raced them. And it was cool to see.
I totally agree. I think they raced really well today as a team. It was really fun to watch them have more numbers to play with as well. I thought, you know, Movistar, like you said, kind of threw these attacks that didn't really seem to make sense, because Van Vleuten at one point was just dropping Liana, and then Liana came back and then just kind of dropped herself. And I wasn't really sure what they were really doing, because it didn't feel like they had the legs for it. But then Trek putting themselves kind of in front of the race a little bit, even when Demi was kind of like far back when Aliza bridged across, you know, that was really smart, I thought, in my mind. And she would kind of put herself further up the climb by the time that Vollering did come across. It was fun to watch. I thought it was a really exciting race. I finished that race, I was like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to talk about it on the podcast. It's so fun.
I was going to point out that, I mean, there was a bit of a theme today in both races, but what was really good to see in Trek, like you were saying, with the strength in numbers that they have now, there was a real confidence to what they did in those last, what was it, 20 kilometres, waiting to catch Sprat before they did that massive push, and then just kind of cracking on, and Sprat helping out for a bit, and Shirin van Anroy doing a massive pull. And it was really, I don't know, because we've got used to seeing SD Works all over the peloton as if there are 12 riders in their jerseys. And then Trek was doing that in the peloton today. Yeah, Russo was up front, so SD Works didn't need to be there, but it was really great to see someone actually taking the race to SD Works.
I want to say that I was a little bit unfair, I think, to the team, because at the end of the day, I think for me coming into this race, it was the first time this year in the Classics where it was so much about Demi Vollering as opposed to Demi Vollering and two or three other people, or at least so I thought. But Marlen Reusser played a really good race today. Obviously, she finished on the podium, and she made it. She really kind of made the race there in the final 20 minutes or so, 30 minutes or so, with her attack, and that really set up Vollering very well. So it really wasn't just Demi Vollering, even on this sort of terrain where I think it's on the Cobble Classics where SD Works really has that dynamic where they can have, it seems like they have 12 riders out there. But even in the Ardennes with Reusser, apparently, who I should give more credit to, I guess, now, they had a good team dynamic and they were able to, win the race. So not much negative you can say about that.
She was incredible on La Redoute, just dropping everyone and putting time into the bunch. It was just kind of, I don't know, if she'd gone and won the race, it would have been no surprise. It was amazing to see.
I really liked how she went in with this, at least from my perspective, went in with the strategy of I'm going to ride hard from the bottom of the climb, and if they attack, they attack and I get dropped, but I'm just going to ride hard because I don't want to do this tempo-changing stuff. And it was very impressive.
She's the way that she was able to ride on a climb that steep really impressed me, because that's, I mean, her skill set to me is more of the big engine, slightly less steep climb kind of race. That's where you would think that she would thrive. And she did thrive off the front solo for a while with her big engine. But to be able to do that much on a gradient like that is really impressive for Reusser.
Yeah, I think I've seen Ellen Van Dyke finish there maybe like fifth a couple years in a row, and she's the same kind of big engine rider. But this race, the climbs are so hard, but if you can just ride your own pace the whole time, and if you're as strong as you are, like these women are, then they'll still finish up there. So I think like Ellen's tactic was always like, Ruth, you can go and try and chase whoever down on the steepest part of the climb when they attack. And I would finish like 50th because I would do that and then completely explode. Meanwhile, Ellen would be like, okay, bye, and pass me on the climb, just doing her own thing. And, you know, Reusser did this today, but she was off the front. She put herself in front sooner, so she got to do that and then just kind of manage instead of going with that really punchy speed from the top climbers, because you saw her not quite be able to hold on to it when Vollering did come across. And I believe she would have if she could have, and she didn't, so...
Going into that finale, I fully expected Vollering to win. Was I right, Ruth, do you think, to expect that? You've raced with Elisa in the past. I would just think in my head that Vollering would be the faster sprinter most of the time. Is that accurate?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it would have been nice to see it a little closer maybe, but I think everybody kind of has watched Demi be pretty strong in some punchy sprints, and Elisa's not slow for sure, but just in that kind of finish. And she's been pretty sick, and you kind of lose a lot of that snappiness as well when you've been off and out of it for a while.
Well, was there anything that you think Elisa could have done in that finale differently to not finish second and finish first, is obviously what I'm trying to get at there?
I'm not sure. I mean, some people, I feel like on the internet, like, oh, she shouldn't have pulled as much because Vollering really wanted the triple and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I don't know. She had to race, you know? Yeah. She couldn't just not race. And she's been in a little bit of a position like that before where she didn't race and she got been told she was a stupid bike racer. And I'm sure that scarred her for life. I think maybe in... No, I was going to tangent about something earlier in the race, but in the specific sprint, I'm not really quite sure. It would have been nice to see maybe Vollering lead it out, but I think Vollering was winning that. She wanted it so badly.
Longoborghini didn't have a ton of cards to play, right? Because Reusser is still back there, and all respect to Raiolini, like, she is not a sprinter. So Vollering could basically stop and wait for that group to catch them without hindering SD Works' ability to win that race. Like, I thought Longoborghini did it pretty well, you know, kind of trying to make it so that the rider behind had the least amount of ground to pass her when the explosion happened. Like, really went side to side, tried to kind of catch Vollering between her rear wheel and the side, just kind of limiting her options. And Vollering was pretty confident. She knew she was going to win it. There's just sometimes you do what you can, you do everything right, and there's just nothing you can do.
Yeah, I think that we've seen actually that over and over again this Classics campaign, where you do everything you can and that's just all you can do, and there's a stronger rider on the day. And there have been a number of races that have played out that way. This Classics campaign, I wanted to bring it to talking about Demi Vollering herself a little bit, and maybe a bit more broadly than just this race today, about what she's done so far this year and sort of where she is in her career and even in the sport generally. I think if you look at her results, the past 5, maybe even 10 years, there have been, I feel like there have been, more often than not, the seasons have either been dominated by Anna van der Breggen or Annemiek van Vleuten. And we've seen that they kind of trading off for a few years there. And I feel like after today, I think Vollering has shown the kind of dominance so far this season that I'm kind of expecting her to finish out this season with that amount of dominance. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw her continue to win in a way that kind of harkened back to what we were seeing from Van der Breggen and Van Vleuten. Meanwhile, Van Vleuten is still in the peloton. It's not as if, you know, Van der Breggen's retired, but Van Vleuten is still here. And so I guess the what I'm building up to is wondering, you know, have we basically seen the end of Van Vleuten's very dominant run? Is that in the past now?
I guess it's hard to say. I think that at some point, yes, you know, she's not won anything so far this spring, and in the past she would have won something already. So this year so far, yes, but that's, I mean, specifically Van Vleuten, but, you know, Vollering, we've seen her still be pretty consistent the last couple years. She was still placing podiums in these races and then still doing super well in July in the racing that we had then. So I have no other expectation other than to see her winning later in the year.
I think with Van Vleuten, I mean, it's definitely seemed in the past few races, like almost when she puts in her attacks and she does her, the body language that is like no other bike rider. And I hope this doesn't sound mean, it doesn't mean to be, but it almost looks like she's accelerating through treacle or something. It's just not got the punch that she's had before. But I do wonder if it's, I mean, we're only in April. Yes, the spring classics are all over, but maybe she really wants to peak for, I mean, that word that we hear a lot in cycling, she wants to peak for the big target of defending the Tour de France and getting all three grand tours. She wants to make sure that she wins something big. And yeah, she hasn't quite got there yet, but she's building up gradually.
Just a note for our listeners, a treacle is, according to Wikipedia, uncrystallized syrup made during the refining of sugar.
Molasses might be a good way to translate it for Americans.
So, apparently it's referenced
What are you talking about, Dave?
Oh, no.
Apparently it's referenced in Tess of the D'Urbervilles, which I read 20 years ago, but I don't, yeah.
Treacle is amazing. Treacle, that means you've never had treacle pudding.
That is accurate. I have never had that. Yeah, it sounds good. Sounds good to me. Yeah,
it's hearty, good winter pudding.
Yeah,
pudding dessert.
Yeah, we'll have to have a big bike race somewhere in
Glasgow.
Sure. Yeah. So then I can talk about the local cuisine. Would treacle be up? I feel like I would hit a number of things before I got to treacle, though. Right. I mean, that's. If I'm talking about the famous local cuisine of Scotland, I.
Oh, yeah, you got haggis, neeps, and
tatties. I was just going to say, I think there would be, various insides of animals that get encased. Yeah, anyway.
Vegetarian haggis is very good.
Cosmo, you had...
I was just going to completely concur. I think it looks a little bit like she's sort of racing herself into shape. I think maybe she's pretty old, right? Like 39, 38, somewhere in there?
40.
She's not over 40 now.
40, yeah. So, like, the idea of maintaining peak fitness, April through July is a big ask, I think. And, if you have to pick the later season targets, I think you kind of have to come into your spring a little bit less on point. I will say, like, the timing of some of her attacks has not made a ton of sense to me. And that may be just she has been strong enough in the past for them to make less sense. But I feel like she's maybe kind of just shaking off the rust still, even at the end of April.
We've mentioned Movistar already, Lippert and Van Vleuten both attacking. Seems like, and it's very easy to do, and you don't really know what your legs are doing until you start pedaling, but it seems like they are trapped in thinking and feeling like they should be, or imagining that they are still in 2022, and it's not quite working out for them. I mean, they're trying. They're not giving up and sitting on the back.
Well, I think it's a really good point to say, like, if in the past you've been able to drop everybody so easily, it makes a big difference where you're going to attack. And we can get to this when we get to the men's race, when you can apparently win Liège-Bastogne-Liège attacking three climbs out. If you're strong enough, and I think Van Vleuten has had that level of strength, and she's been at that level and has had that much of a margin over the rest of the women's peloton for so long, that it probably does change the equation pretty dramatically, that she's maybe still trying to figure out, okay, when does 2023 Annemiek van Vleuten attack? When's the right time for that? Because she's not as dominant as she was. And yeah, now it's Demi Vollering, and I've said this, I think, twice already during the classics, but just hats off to Danny Stam for what he has managed to build over there with, it seems like, they don't have Anna van der Breggen and Chantal van der Broeck Black, and they're still dominating. And, there was a period where those two were sort of the newer riders on the team, and they were dominating. So
I do want to give Annemiek van Vleuten a little bit of credit, because she did do a really good attack. I know we're talking about Liège, but in Flèche Wallonne, she attacked the first time up the Muir de Huy, and I thought it was a really good breakaway that was with one lap to go of the course. So,
and at the end of the day, I mean, she's still finishing pretty highly in these
races. Yeah, she's finishing top 10 in all of these races.
She's not falling off a cliff or anything, for sure.
Yeah, by all accounts, it's a great. She's had a good season. Like I said, I didn't want to, my treacle comment. I didn't want to be. Yeah, it's one of those things where you've got the rainbow bands and you've got the target on your back and you are Annemiek van Vleuten. You win everything, but it's also the final season, so there's an awful lot of pressure. So yeah, it can't be easy to have that much expectation. But yeah. I don't know. I think she's a very interesting rider to watch. And she did initiate the accelerations on La Redoute in the peloton. She wanted to get things going. So she's very determined to keep the racing moving. And that's always great to see.
Before we move on to the men's race, I think I want to give a shout out to SDWorks for sort of defying a lot of conventional wisdom around teamwork in cycling. And maybe I put air quotes around that conventional wisdom. I describe it as maybe the sort of things you'd see in an internet comment about how someone did a bad job, like, oh, they attacked and they had to team it up the road. That's bad. And there were, multiple times today where Vollering was nominally leading the chase. It's the first next rider down the road with Reusser up the road. And it wasn't like she was making it any less likely for SDWorks to win the race.
I think it was really fun to watch that because Demi obviously had so much want to win this race. She wanted to win all three. But it also just seemed to me, particularly on the climb, when they were getting super close to Reusser, that they were going to come back. To me, it seemed like they were going to come back. And then once she came back, then everyone was just going to be watching Vollering to attack anyway. So it didn't hurt them at all for her to be kind of like, whatever, chasing. I don't really see it that way because the group was just moving faster anyway. And when Demi had to do the effort to get up to Longo Borghini and kind of move up anyway, that was, to me, it was just like a cool way to use your teammates. And then she just could play that card and save more energy with Reusser right behind her so close to the finish. I thought it was really fun to watch.
Certainly seems like they kind of have it dialed. I mean,
yeah, it was definitely instinctive today.
Yeah, they. It's funny that like a month ago we were sort of talking about intra-team strife, and then they've gone on to just like crush everybody with good teamwork, with really good teamwork for the last several weeks. All right, men's race. There was a race-altering crash in the early goings.
Heartbreak.
So sad.
Potentially even a sort of 2023 bike racing season altering crash. We'll get to that. And I'm sure the placeholders will talk a fair bit about that. Cosmo, what happened in this race?
There was 100 kilometers of lead out by Sudal Quickstep. We may have previously have referred to them as the bad classics team, but they rode hard at the front for a long time. Remco Evenepoel attacked. Pidcock kind of could follow him. Ben Healy was close, and then Remco went away and never came back. There was an interesting tactical regroup in the battle for second a couple of times, actually. Thinned out to about three riders, I think, and Pidcock won the sprint. Ben Healy lost it, I'm blanking on the name of the Bahrain guy in third, and I feel
Santiago
bad.
Buitrago.
Thank you.
The crasher I didn't actually name.
Yes.
Is, of course, Tadej Pogacar, the two-time Tour de France winner. Former Liège-Bastogne-Liège winner, and heading into the day, the favorite to win the race, he crashed and sustained some fractures in his wrist, scaphoid, and maybe one other bone.
Yes, there was the... It had a cool name.
Required surgery, so he had surgery. Instead of winning Liège-Bastogne-Liège today, he had surgery, which is probably not what he woke up thinking was going to be happening. Probably not the best way to spend your Sunday. And I think it has to be said, after the incredible spring campaign that he has had and the general dominance in so many different ways, he was, I think, and still may be, an obvious favorite for the Tour de France. And now this just changes a lot of the conversation. Now it's going to be, can he recover quickly enough? What's he going to be like when he gets back and on the bike? And so we're podcasting hours after his surgery, so we have obviously no answers to that, and we won't have any answers to that for a while. But that's definitely going to be, I think, a big talking point for the rest of the season, is Pogacar's injury that he sustained today in a crash that happened before TV coverage, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, quite a long time before.
Unless other places had TV coverage before we did. Yeah, so we didn't see what happened, really. We just kind of heard Paddy Pogacar out of the race. And then it really was, I think, all eyes on Remco Evenepoel, who already had plenty of eyes on him as the defending champion and as the guy wearing rainbow stripes and also white shorts.
I turned on the TV whenever I woke up, and no one had mentioned Tadej yet. And I was like, why is no one talking about him? And then Zach was like, checked whatever the internet, and I was like, he's crashed out. And I'm like, I don't care. What is this bike race anymore? Yeah. I was so excited. I'm so heartbroken. Like, what are we watching? Where's the battle? And then, I don't know. So my enthusiasm for this one is not quite the same as it was for the women's.
No, absolutely agree. I was really excited to get that battle that we've been waiting for between Pogacar and Evenepoel. I thought there was a very good chance that Evenepoel would attack, Tadej Pogacar would latch on and then say, see you later, mate. But still, it would have been great to get the two of them, you know, whether it was a Pogacar show or an Evenepoel show, or if they duked it out to the line. I was really looking forward to that that duel that we've not yet seen, I don't think. Obviously they've raced together, but they've not really had that mano a mano match yet.
We've been watching one guy smash everybody in every race he started, and finally he starts a race with another guy expected to smash everybody, and we lost. We did not get our smash. Well, we did get smashing, but it was two smashy people did not.
And I hate this conversation because I hate being the person that's like, if and when, but. I'm like, this is bike racing. It doesn't matter. I don't want to talk about this hypothetical bike race that didn't happen. If the person didn't, like, whatever, this is how it works.
We don't have a whole lot else to talk about, though, because it was just so... I can't... Yeah. I'm honestly, like, Pat Lefevre should be buying everybody a nice fancy lunch at whatever that place he's been to for all the classics races has been, because his team rode really, really well.
They did, and it was extremely impressive. Like, there's no denying his impressive feat at all.
It was a Soudal Quickstep that we haven't really seen at the Classics. Maybe that's a little bit harsh because they have tried to win races, but they, in one-day events. They were on the front the whole day, and it looked like, you know, the commentators hypothesized that maybe they were burning matches too soon. I did a little bit of that myself, I have to admit. But, you know, the team's finish line was Laredout. So the fact that Van Wilder was the only one left, that was fine. That was all he needed to do. He just needed to get Pogacar to 34 kilometres to go and leave him, not Pogacar, Evenepoel. Still sad. Then just let him go. And it worked. So the confidence was very well founded.
I was not at all surprised that Remco Evenepoel won the race when Tadej Pogacar crashed out. I think everybody assumed that's probably what was going to happen. But I was very surprised that he basically won the race on Laredout, because it is so far out from the finish now. They added the Côte de Forge back this year, and you still have to go over the Rochefoucauld. This race has come so far, proverbially, from being the... wait around until the final kilometer uphill finish race. And that, yes, Remco Evenepoel attacked last year on Laredout as well, but it's even farther this year, and there was another climb in between it and the finish this year, and he's still, as you said, that was sort of their finish line. They set him up to go on that climb, knowing he is that good, that he can go there and hold on. And of course, you can hold on if you are somebody like Remco Evenepoel going solo when you're that good at time trialing. So it just... a perfect plan. They really play this one to perfection, and I don't know that there's anything anybody else could have done today. To me, they're like, it's what I can't think of any tactical decision. He attacked from so far. The only other thing you could say is, okay, maybe attack from farther out than them, but you would just get chased down. Nobody's going to attack from farther out than Laredout and make it to the finish. So I feel like they just played this one perfectly, and it's what you can do if you are that strong.
So Jumbo actually kind of tried with Tratnik. He put on a pretty good show out on the course with a very early attack. They brought him back when they wanted to, for sure. But it definitely, when he and Sheffield went, I was like, okay, I kind of see this kind of getting a group up ahead the way we saw at Flanders, where a lot of kind of stronger names got up ahead before the kind of expected Pogacar attack. Tratnik actually maybe rode too hard because he dropped the two people who went with him, you know, within a couple of kilometers. So, but it was sort of tried.
They did. I think that's basically just the point, though. It's that you attacking farther out than Laredout is too far, and if you don't attack from farther out Laredout, then you're going to lose to Evenepoel. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah, Trek tried a couple of times. Well, a couple of times, maybe not accurate, but Bakayoko attacked and momentarily isolated Evenepoel, but it seemed to be more of a test to see what Soudal Quickstep would do and whether he would stay isolated or something. I'm not sure. And it was so far out that it was never, Mollema was never going to crack on. And then there was the odd two up Trek Segafredo chase group that didn't seem to be working together on the descent off Laridou in pursuit of Evenepoel. And that was basically the last we saw of Trek. But yeah, Ineos spent a lot of time, well, I say a lot of time, in comparison to every other team minus Soudal Quickstep, Ineos seemed to be determined to mimic what Soudal Quickstep was doing. But yeah, it was, there was very clearly one team heads and shoulders above the rest.
I feel like that is the other big unknown, that Pogacar being the main one, but you know, Pidcock's entire Classics campaign this year kind of derailed by a crash and a concussion, and yet he still ended up having some really good results even after his Strade Bianche win. I think if you're Ineos, you play it the way you play it today, just hoping he is at 100% and maybe, you know, okay, he's at 90%, so he didn't win, he finished second. But I think that they probably played it as best they could.
I will say Pidcock came back really well. When Evenepoel finally dropped him, like, he immediately, he didn't respond. He just he reached out, grabbed a bottle, like, stuffed some food into his mouth and kind of waited for the race to second to regroup. And I'm wondering, he's still, this is purely speculative on my part for all but, for last week at Amstel. I think at Flanders, he came out and said he had a hunger flat. At Amstel, he really seemed to kind of, like, I don't know, fade out a little bit at a certain point. And I'm wondering if he's still kind of coming back from that concussion, trying to get his feeding back together where it was. Because not only was he kind of seemed to have this dead need to feed moment, 30K out, but he was also freezing after the race, like uncommonly cold, I think, for what he was expecting. Because, I mean, they were not ready to have like a super warm coat for him at the finish line. He literally said, "Oh, I'm bloody cold," in one of the interviews and was like visibly shivering on the podium. It was kind of amazing to me that Ineos never came in with their attention to marginal gains and, you know, got him warm. Yeah, just, I don't think you can warm yourself back up putting on layers of thin spandex over other wet layers of thin spandex. Hasn't been my experience anyway.
That's too big of a gain. So it's only marginal gains is what they try to work on. Being warm, that's too big of a deal. Santiago Buitrago was your third place finisher. He's had quite a nice year. Won a stage of the Giro last year. Now finished on the podium at Liège, and he's only 23 years old. So I think Bahrain Victorious has to be happy with that signing. I was kind of pulling for Ben Healy to kind of land on that podium after his Amstel Gold Race, though, finishing the top five in Brabantse-Pale, Amstel, and Liège. Really nice ride from him and from EF. Another top finish from EF, which, yeah, I think the team has to be happy with the way that they've been consistently contending.
And he said he wasn't climbing that well. In his post-race interview, he's like, "Oh, I'm missing a little something on the climbs." And I'm like, at one point, you dropped everyone except for Remco. Not permanently, but distanced them on climbs in this race. So that's pretty good. If he's missing something off his climbing,
yeah,
like, look out.
He's at least the second EF rider this spring to say, if you'd asked me last week, would I be satisfied with X place, a top five finish, he'd have been delighted, but now he's disappointed because, and that just goes to show the form that he's in. The first one was Paulus at Roubaix. Was it Roubaix? Flanders. But yeah, so that team is just flying. And Healy is, I don't know if you saw what EF put on Instagram yesterday, their Wes Anderson inspired reel, but they seem to pick up on a likeness between Healy and Anderson. Now I can only see him in a corduroy suit. Healy, that is.
Yeah, so, that was nice. I liked that. Good marketing. Yeah.
I want to see it.
Oh, one other thing I wanted to point out, this kind of going back to the race-defining, quote-unquote attack. I just wanted to note, I don't really have a strong point to make here other than I don't know that I've ever seen less of an attack than when Evenepoel dropped Pidcock today. He hardly even accelerated. It was just like Pidcock had gone so deep trying to stay on his wheel that when Evenepoel left him behind, it was like he barely had to do anything. He was just, he couldn't hold on.
Yeah, he just discovered that he was alone and ran with it.
Yeah, and oh, I guess I go win now. Seemed like the, yeah. And he did. So good for him.
And because of that, I was also super just impressed that Pidcock didn't completely explode. Because to me, it just seemed like he tried so hard. And then, he did just kind of fade off the wheel, I guess, and he decided that. But I was just really impressed that he still got second in the end. Because he has also been in races where he just gives everything. And then, I don't know if he realizes he's not going to win, or if he does just completely ride himself into the ground and then finishes somewhere that we don't care about.
Yeah, he said in his interview that Evenepoel had asked if he would take a turn. He said, I just really can't. But yeah, what you said about his resurgence towards the finish made me think that, and it's so, we see this all the time in bike racing, people coming back to the front, having had a bit of a breather, but on a massive race like today, so 260 almost kilometres, it's a slog. So you wouldn't be at all surprised if somebody did just completely blow up. But we saw it several times with the Quickstep riders who would, Alaphilippe looked like he popped twice or three times. Louis Vervaeke did exactly the same thing, just go and sit on the back and recover. And so they're giving themselves a chance to recover. They understand their bodies well enough to know that they can do that and then go and put in another massive effort and either get a medal or help their teammate get a medal. And I don't know. I mean, maybe that's not a particularly interesting takeaway, but I was struck by how there was a real intention and confidence and I don't know, the heads didn't drop when they physically get dropped by somebody else. And I think that's maybe something that comes with monuments and grand tours. You get that, you know, unstoppable determination.
Cosmo, you had more to say about people being cold after this race, not just Pidcock.
I was just amazed to see the person who just smashed everybody and clearly, you know, his biggest vulnerability is almost certainly not going to be other riders, but things that might happen to him, like crashing or getting sick. And he's sitting in his wet, visibly discolored skin suit, soaking wet, talking into a camera, you know, out in the wind in a not particularly warm day. And no one from his team has, you know, come over and put, you know, a warm coat on him or taken off his wet helmet and put on a dry helmet. It seems to me like this is, like I said with Pidcock, I get it. Like, after a race, you're hyped up. You got race brain. You're not thinking about this stuff. But this is what the support team is for, right? To help you with the stuff that you really can't help yourself with as a racer.
The temperature clearly dropped precipitously in that final run into the finish. I mean, they were all very wet. There was a lot of descending. I remember seeing Alaphilippe crossing the line, and his jaw was visibly quaking as his teeth chattered, and he pulled up to the team staff and he could not have looked colder if he tried. He couldn't even set his jaw. And they all looked cold on the podium. You quite often see it in cyclocross, but it just, yeah, I totally agree. In a sport when everyone's so well looked after, we seem to get the idea that particularly on the big teams were marginal gains. I felt for them.
All right, that's our Liège breakdown, our Monday morning DSing of the final monument of the spring. There's one more monumental classic, of course, but that's not until the leaves start to fall in northern Italy. So we're really transitioning out of one-day racing and into the bigger stage races of the year, which nicely dovetails into the last part of the show. Let's just tell you what's coming up in the world of bike racing. This week, we have what in my opinion, is the most scenic bike race on the world tour, the Tour de Romandie, which takes riders through the French-speaking part of Switzerland and is just one amazing mountain vista after another. So that is going to kick off this week in the French-speaking part of Switzerland, and it is a little bit sort of strangely located on the calendar, where I think it's too close to the Giro for any real Giro contenders to go. But we will get to see a handful of big names. I think both of the Yates brothers, Simon and Adam, will be there. Sergio Higuita is expected to be there. I believe the Ineos Grenadiers are sending Egan Bernal.
Yeah, I think it's the race that typically the Team Sky, then Ineos riders, would, the Tour de France favourites, would go and win quite often in the rain at Remondi, I seem to remember. But yeah, it was one of the Froome Wiggins build-up races towards the Tour de France.
I remember it also being a Simon Spielak, you know,
yes,
world championships every year. He was always really good there. Him and Rui Costa really liked racing in Switzerland for a little while. That was always fun to watch.
Well, part of that, the course is fairly unique. Like, it's not just a mini Grand Tour. Like, it's, there are kind of intermediate climby, sprinty things where you'll have like a Cat 2 climb and then a descent into the finish, which is cool. I like it when races have their own unique persona.
And also, for the moment, at least according to the provisional start list, it will be an opportunity to see Mark Cavendish sprinting at the World Tour level, which we haven't had that many opportunities for. I mean, just, there just haven't really been that many stage races yet. And I think he and his team are very anxious to start winning some races, because that has been something that has eluded them in general so far this year. Asana team having one of the worst years in recent memory, but fortunately for them, Alexei Lutsenko did finally go out and win some races, won the Giro di Sicilia the other day, and he is also expected to be in Romandy. So
that's a little interesting, like, because I don't think of it as a tremendous hotbed of group sprints, again, with that kind of like unique finish pattern.
Well, there is a prologue of 6.8 kilometers, and maybe he has his eye on that. You never know.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, it seems like a strange build-up for the Giro, especially as it's, I mean, unless it's a training camp, because
I feel like it's less weird.
Do the half Giro.
Yeah, well, that's also very true. Yeah,
so at least one big-name sprinter, a handful of others as well. Gino Mader, the Yates brothers, Egan Bernal, who I keep saying we will hopefully get to see back to his best sometime soon. Maybe he'll start to do that in Romandy. That's going to get started on Tuesday. And we're not far now from the Giro d'Italia, by the way. So lots to look forward to in the stage racing department. That's all. That's all we have here for the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast today. We're glad you joined us, of course. And Cosmo, Ruth, Kit, great talking to you. Listeners, we'll leave you with a little bit more of the Liège Bastogne Liège Chorale. See you next week. Bastogne, Liège, 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 Bastog